Okay, welcome back to our final session of Daniel. Today is the last Sunday of the summer quarter.
Oh, for Pete's sake, friends.
Let's begin with prayer. Lord, we thank you for all the insights into your plan of salvation that you reveal to us in your word. Help us always to be growing in our knowledge and in our faith. But help us to understand, too, that you are an omniscient God, that we cannot comprehend all the things that you have planned for us. Help us, though, to understand those things that are important for us to know, that you would have us know. Help us to be content with what you have revealed to us. But help us always to be striving, to learn more, and to grow more. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, we are at Daniel chapter 11, verse 31. Last time, we had begun chapter 11. Chapter 11 gives us the final vision that Daniel received from an angel, and it concerns especially what was going to happen in the coming kingdom of Greece that would spread across the Middle East and across the known world after Daniel's day. And much of chapter 11 is simply recording the constant battles between the king of the north, who is the king of Syria, and the king of the south, who was the king of Egypt at that time. Not really the Pharaoh of Egypt, because by this time the high point of the Egyptian culture had passed, and it really was a Greek king that had taken over Egypt. Most of the king's names, they passed it down from father to son, their names were Ptolemy, and they were the kings of the south. Most of the first half of chapter 11 simply talks about the constant conflict, the constant invading that these two kings did into one another's territory. And I said to you, that was part of the previous lesson, we had written down verse by verse each of the invasions that took place, and we used study helps to figure out what was Daniel, or what was the angel really foretelling, which historical event that was to come after Daniel's time. But I don't know if it's that profitable to go through all of those historical events that were being predicted to Daniel. However, I do think starting at verse 31 would be a good idea. And so that's where I started us on our lesson for this past week. Daniel 11, verse 31. By this time, we are into the 100s BC, and a king by the name of Antiochus has become the king of the north, the kingdom of Syria. And it's him that we're going to be discussing. So get set with your sheet, beginning at Daniel 11:31. Have your Bible opened. I have one other announcement. If you did not get yet one of the surveys, one of the exit surveys, please raise your hand. Pastor Carr likes to have everybody who attends Bible class be able to give their constructive input to help us improve Bible classes. So at the end of this quarter, we would like everyone to fill one out. Leon, if you could please hand them out. Anyone who didn't get one yet, please raise your hand, and Leon will get one to you. You can either fill it out during class today and hand it to me at the end of class, or you can fill it out and get it to me later. Okay? We would just like your input on how we can improve classes like Daniel. Okay, now let's actually start with Daniel 11, verse 31. We're talking about the contemptible person, is the way he was described in verse 21. Let me just read 21 first. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. This is the contemptible person who is still being discussed in verse 31.
We know him today because this prophecy has been fulfilled. We know him as Antiochus the Fourth, who also took the name Epiphanes. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. In your study guide for this week, it said, the vision that we began last time climaxes in the contemptible person, mentioned in verse 21, which most interpreters of Daniel agree is referring to Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, who ruled a Greek kingdom centered in Syria from 175 to 164 BC. Look up Antiochus in a Bible dictionary and find out as much as you can about how he desecrated the temple and set up the abomination that causes desolation. What did you find out about Antiochus? Gwen?
I'm trying to make it quick. he took over, he assumed the throne from his brother who had been assassinated. It said that he ruled in 175 before Christ. Mm-hmm. That he appointed someone named Menelaus to be the a high priest, and the Jews weren't really going for it while he was away on his battles. And then when he returned, he made him the high priest again, and he was trying to make sure that the Jews started to worship Zeus, and that's why he did what he did in the temple, which later caused the revolt.
Good. Okay. He was, first of all, not supposed to be king. He took over when his brother was assassinated. It really was his nephew who was next in line for the kingship. So he was politically very... he put himself forward, did things illegally to become king. And then these Greek kings would always try to inject themselves into the Jewish religion. He put somebody in the position of high priest who he thought would kind of help him with his reforms that he wanted to bring about with the Jewish people. And then what he really wanted to do was gradually shift them from Jewish religion to Greek religion. He wanted them to worship Zeus, who is the king of the Greek gods. Anybody find anything else out about Antiochus? Michelle.
You had mentioned Zeus and the statue. One note that I found is that he had made that statue in the likeness of himself. Mm. And also that he had destroyed Jewish scriptures, and he was burning alive dissidents, sacrificing pigs, ritual prostitution, abolishing the Sabbath day.
Yes. Yeah, he really wanted to get rid of the Jewish religion. Abolish the Sabbath day, burn Jewish scriptures, stop people from circumcising their children. He really wanted to squelch Judaism. And then the whole thing about sacrificing a pig on this altar that was in the place of the altar of burnt offering in front of the temple. That's the main way in which he desecrated it. Made statues, or at least a statue of this god Zeus, made it to look like him, because he was really, many people, historians who wrote back in his day, felt that he was insane, and had this megalomania of wanting to be God. Anyone else? David?
I also read that the placement of the statue was important too, because he placed it in the temple. Mm-hmm. The statue of Zeus in his own image.
Hmm. Right in the temple. I found differing accounts as I was going around as in different sources reading about it. One source said that he only erected an altar to Zeus there. Another source I read, though, too, said about the statue of Zeus and placing it in the temple. So I'm not sure if different historians have conflicting accounts or what.
I also said when I read about the the fighting between the king of the north and the king of the south, that there were actually Jewish people who sided with Antiochus.
Yes.
And so they kind of went off to battle with him. And I guess it wasn't until he did what he did in the temple that they realized that it probably wasn't the best idea for them to align themselves.
Yes. And I think that may come up in our next verse, huh? 32. With flattery he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. I think that's referring to the Jewish people. How some sided with Antiochus, while others remained faithful to the Jewish culture and the Jewish faith. Did anyone else find anything out about desecrating the temple? Or the abomination that causes desolation? Go ahead.
Well, it said that not only did he sacrifice the pig, but he tried to make the Jewish priest, I guess, that was in the temple eat the pig too, which would have made it even worse. Mm-hmm. And they refused, so it said that he cut off their hands, their feet, and their tongues, mm-hmm. and then burned them alive on God's altar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book of Maccabees contains that account that Gwen is talking about, that it was a priest, I didn't remember that, who refused to eat part of the sacrifice, that he mutilated him, had him burned, and I believe even members of his family burned. So he was not a nice guy, to say the least. Nope. Okay, the next question, unless anybody has anything further on Antiochus, the next question deals with verses 32 through 34. With flattery he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword, or be burned, or captured, or plundered. There's the prophecy of what would happen to those Jews who remained faithful. That actually did happen in reality in the days of Antiochus. 34. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. During times of persecution, there are some people who will nominally say we're still part of the religion, but when they actually get persecuted and maybe have their life threatened, if they're half-hearted, they will say, no, I don't really believe this, in order to escape the persecution. And I think that's who's being described there in verse 34. Now, this was another assignment that was given during the week. This period of Israel's history is sometimes referred to as the Maccabean period, named after a Jewish leader, Judas Maccabeus, who led the rebellion that freed the Jews from Antiochus. Using a Bible dictionary and looking under words like Maccabees, find out more about the resistance of the faithful Jews that is alluded to in Daniel 11, 32 through 34. Was anybody able to look up things on the Maccabees? Joyce.
It started with an old priest named Mattathias. And apparently some of the Aristotle and the Athenians, people were going to sacrifice a heathen sacrifice in his town, so he, quote, struck them down before they killed him. And just, anyway, everybody was after him, so he ran and killed with all of his sons. He didn't live long, but one of his sons took over Judas Maccabeus and led a very successful long revolt against Antiochus.
Exactly. The father of this family was a priest by the name of Mattathias, who lived in a village, and when the underlings of Antiochus tried to sacrifice to these Greek gods in his village, he would not allow it. He struck down the person who was trying to make the sacrifice, and then he began to hide out in the hills of the hill country of Judea, and he had five sons. And they started what was really kind of like guerrilla warfare, in which two of his sons were killed, but three remained alive. And the first one was a man by the name of Judas, who later received the nickname Maccabeus, which is a Greek form of a Hebrew word for hammer. Judas the hammer.
He led the revolt at first and was quite successful. He was even able to recapture the Temple Mount in Jerusalem within about 3 years of the time that it had been desecrated. And he was able to get the temple rededicated to the Lord. They cleaned it out, they cleansed it, purified it, and were able to begin the sacrifices again to the Lord. Does anybody know the name of the Jewish celebration of this event?
Hanukkah.
Hanukkah, right? Hanukkah is the Hebrew word for rededication or renewal. And it's when they were able to get the temple back from these Greeks who had desecrated it. He was able to capture it in December of that year, and that's why they celebrate Hanukkah about when we celebrate Christmas. Hanukkah is older, but many Christians are confused by it because it's not in the Bible, because it took place in that period between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. So there's no Bible book that describes this event. However, we do know that even Jesus himself celebrated Hanukkah, because it's either in John 7 or John 10, I always get those mixed up, where Jesus went to Jerusalem to celebrate Hanukkah and made one of his major speeches there in the temple courts while he was there for Hanukkah. So it was already around in Jesus' day. And actually, there were two more sons of Mattathias that, after the time of Judas, continued this revolt against the Greeks. Did anybody get their names?
We didn't get their names. I just saw that they actually ruled for 100 years. They were able to go to the temple, and they were able to worship their God for 100 years without a lot, yes, of content. Contention from the others, but it did say that even that there was a dissension between should they continue the fight for religious freedom or for political power, and that's when the Sadducees and the Pharisees came about.
That's right. Mm-hmm. There were two brothers after Judas. The first one was Jonathan. He led this revolt after Judas died, and then after him was a brother by the name of Simon. So for a whole generation, for about 30 years, this battling went on. And part of the reason this revolt never ended is because the Jewish people themselves could never find themselves in unity with one another over this. The Pharisees got their start in this period. They were called the Hasidim in those days. And sometimes these Hasidim would side with the Maccabeans. And at other times, they thought that the Maccabeans were going too far, and they didn't agree with them, had different philosophies and ideologies, and they would sometimes go back and start siding with the Greeks again. So the whole thing continued to go on, mainly because of lack of unity among the Jewish people themselves. But they were able to reestablish the worship at the temple, and so, to a certain extent, the Jewish faith was able to rally after this terrible persecution they had gone through. Joyce.
It was one of the things I thought was interesting that Simon became the high priest as well as the military governor, sort of wore two hats, mm-hmm, and that then the high priesthood became hereditary from that point
from his family.
Herod's people came in.
I was reading the same thing, that Simon not only was the political leader but also became the priest. And the source I was reading it from, I was wondering, was he a descendant of Aaron?
Well, wouldn't he have to be if Mattathias was, weren't all priests?
That's true, yes, if his father was also priest. You're right. What would sometimes happen in this Greek period, though, is that the Greek king would want to put somebody who was favorable to him in that role of high priest, and he would sometimes put someone in who was not from the line of Aaron, and that would cause contention among the Jewish people. Good.
Get off the topic, but I just found that it was kind of a uniqueness reading this story, because I was intrigued. I was on the in the encyclopedia online, and I was able to get a lot of information. It just seemed like there's a lot of parallels to this part in the history to the Holocaust.
Yes, that is true. With the people being burned, mutilated.
And the freedom, and, the religious freedom versus, political solidarity, a land of their own, just seemed to me like a lot of parents.
You're absolutely right. This period of their history is very important to Jewish people. And I am sure that the modern Jewish people who established the State of Israel again were kind of living on the reminiscences of this period of time. Wanting to recapture the Temple Mount, wanting to reinstitute everything, both religiously and politically. You're absolutely right. They get a lot of their inspiration from this period of their history. Yes?
Is this something new, or had it happened before that someone from the line of Aaron was actually fighting? I mean, you don't think of them in that role.
That's true.
Here the Maccabeans are taking charge of the revolt. That doesn't seem like something...
Like the priestly thing to do, right?
No.
I think it would be the first time that I can think of off the top of my head where a priest would be involved in warfare. Okay, anything else about the Maccabees? Paul?
I think through all of this, a lot of refining was happening. The strengthening of the religion was being reinitiated, and people that would normally not look to religion were turning to it.
Yes.
What helped strengthen their position and allow them to get back into that temple and they're rededicated, made a stronger core that they didn't have before. So a lot of this bad things, good comes from.
That often happens in religions, right? Where during a time of persecution, that's when the people rediscover their roots or why they believe things the way they do. So I'm sure it was a period of rallying the Jewish people to their faith. Somebody was trying to rob them of it, and they were going to hold on to it. It was a period of solidification for them. Okay? Another thing I wanted to point out is that the date for Hanukkah. I found in my sources that there isn't agreement on it. Some sources will say 165 BC, and others say 164 BC. This is an example of how these ancient dates are sometimes hard to pinpoint. But the date is known. The Jewish month around December is called Kislev, and it happened on the 25th of Kislev. Now, their months don't always line up exactly with ours, so it isn't necessarily December 25th. As you know, it kind of roves around the calendar because they do lunar months. But it happened on Kislev 25, either in 165 or 164 BC. Okay, going on to verse 35. Some of the wise will stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. My question in connection with this one is, why did the Lord allow the Jews to go through these terrible times? Apply this to all generations of God's people, including our own generation. Why does God allow his people to undergo persecution? Because it strengthens them, yes. Because it strengthens their faith. Tell me more about why would persecution strengthen someone's faith? Suzanne?
Well, our hearts are hard and it gets our attention.
Yes, our hearts are hard. Persecution gets our attention. It shakes us up and makes us realize that we're not so firm on our own, that we need to look to God, right? Probably the biggest shakeup that we've had in the last 10 years was 9/11, right? And it did shake many people to the core. But of course, the sad thing with it was that, what was it, within a year, they could show the statistics. Church attendance went up after 9/11, and then about a year after, it went right back down to the level it had been before. Someone else? Fred?
Well, we always turn, I think most more eager to turn to the Lord when there's trouble. And as soon as the trouble is over with, it's very easy to forget that we were there and that the Lord helped us.
Yes. We have a tendency to turn to the Lord in times of trouble, right? Otherwise, when things are going well, we're self-confident, right? We don't feel we need him as Sabbath. But when the rug gets pulled out from under us, then we need to look elsewhere for support. Pam?
I was reading somewhere, and I know I've heard it before, and I can't give you reference, but it was talking about how God whispers to us when things are calm in our life, and he seems to shout to us when we are suffering. So we listen. God seems to be trying to wake us up when suffering.
He's trying to get our attention,
right?
Mark?
I was just going to say, I really love reading history because history really helps you out. When you look in the Old Testament, that's history. It shows the people of Israel, all the times that they mess up and go away from the Lord and then they come back and you think, how could they be so dumb to do that? And then we look at ourselves today, too, throughout our history as Americans, and we've had the same thing. You know, there's times where we have war, bad things happen, and we're all, God, you're, you know, really with you, and then when it starts smooth sailing again, we just fall away.
The cycles are constant, right, throughout history. The book of Judges is the one I always think of. The people would go over to worship these other gods, and the Lord would hand them over to the Midianites or somebody who would invade the country, and then they would repent of their sins, and the Lord would send a deliverer and deliver them, and for a while they had a period of peace, and then they'd go right back into it. I think those periods were 40-year periods, which are interesting because that's about the prime of life for an adult person. It's like every generation has to be taught the lesson. Gwen?
My assumption is that this all happened after the Jews went back to the temple.
Yes.
So they obviously started messing up again.
Good point. Let's keep this in perspective. When did Daniel live again? Approximately? Yeah, about 600, more in the 500s. He lived throughout the 500s BC. And this is taking place now in the 100s BC. So this is something like 400 years after Daniel received the vision, right? Remember that this whole thing is a vision of what's going to happen in the future. So Gwen's putting us in the right context. Remember, Daniel was in the Babylonian captivity. He was kept in Babylon, but he was given these visions that the people of Israel will be able to return home, be able to rebuild the temple, we heard about that last time, and after they have worshipped in that temple for a number of centuries, again something terrible would happen to them where the temple is taken away from them. Yeah, so, good. Rosemary?
Well, this is in the same relation to this. I think we get too caught up, and this really shows that the difference between God's kingdom and the kingdoms on earth. And sometimes persecution or troubles let us focus on God's kingdom and not what's going on.
We have a distinction in Daniel between the spiritual kingdom and the earthly kingdom, right? He's shown us interesting hints about how Michael and some of the angels were battling over which kingdom would come next on the earth. But he shows there's a distinct difference between the spiritual kingdom and the earthly kingdom. And so often in times of trouble is when we go to the spiritual kingdom because we know that the earthly kingdom is kind of breaking up. Right? Okay, good. Let's keep moving. The next section, I'm going to read all of, let me just read the next paragraph, starting with 36. The king who exalts himself. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed. For what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his fathers. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god, and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people, and will distribute the land at a price. The question in connection with this paragraph says, what kinds of sin led Antiochus to treat God's people so cruelly? What would lead a depraved human mind to think about these, to think along these lines? Okay, he's fearful of them, right? Because they have a God, and he's not that God, right? What is the tendency of the sinful mind, according to the picture of Antiochus here? What does it tend for?
The power of greed.
Egotism, right? Power, greed. Think about it once. This isn't just a sin that kings commit, like Antiochus. What was the very first temptation that Adam and Eve received in the Garden of Eden? You will be like God, knowing good and evil. Very first temptation, right? I think most of us, we grew up in a Christian family, or we grew up learning self-control just in outward things, that we don't even realize that this tendency exists in our heart to want to be God. But it's a very common tendency. We've seen it already in Daniel. Who else wanted to be God in Daniel? Nebuchadnezzar, remember? These guys who get all this political earthly power, they kind of have an easier time of letting it go to their head and letting it get out of control, right? But I really think that for each of us, it exists on the inside. We just don't let it out. Pastor Waterstrat and I were discussing a pastoral item for somebody that we know who has severe psychological problems. And part of the psychological problems that are manifested in this person is, I am God. When the mind gets out of control, it tends in this direction. We want to be God. It's like Miriam said, he's ruling over these people who don't think that he is the ultimate one in control. That's scary to somebody who wants to be on top of everyone. And as the history writers say, he had psychological problems. He had a mania about him. I've shared his nickname with you. He called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphany, you know what it means from church. Showing forth, you know, showing the divine splendor. He thought he was God. But his contemporaries made fun of him and called him, there was just one letter different in the Greek language to another word, Epimenes, which means a little touched in the head. That's the way they made fun of him for taking on this title. So, he obviously is out of his mind and wants this godlike power. Anything else with his thinking?
I was thinking that haven't we throughout history had people that have put themselves in the position of a god? Mm-hmm. And what, like, I mean, and then they want to just follow me because I am the divine one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been going on since the beginning.
Yes.
And in Adam and Eve's behalf, I mean, the devil kind of gave them a half-truth. They did know the difference between good and evil.
Yes.
They just didn't become like God.
Yeah. And in a certain sense, man can become like God, right? In that we get God's grace and his qualities. We are his children. You know, but the devil was, you know, dealing in half-truths and played to this this appetite that we want to be God. Yes, David?
You know, my translation is a little different in 38, and it says, but instead he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. What I thought about was, I thought about him creating a god. And don't we all do that?
Yeah.
And there are gods of materialism, there are gods of all kinds of things that we may not even know we're doing. Mm-hmm. But that subtle idea that, you know, we, even if we don't say, well, I'm God, we might be following a God that we created.
True, yes. It could be a God that he created. He will honor a God of fortresses. How could a king or a ruler honor a God of fortresses?
Put his trust in his walls and his
armor. If I have enough protection, then I will not have to worry about somebody conquering me. And so these walls over here, those are my God. Hey, Mark.
Well, I was just saying, you know, it's like that's Nebuchadnezzar's big thing. He goes, can anybody build like what I have built? Look at me. Look at how I have God. Like, I'm like God. And as soon as he said that, God said, that's it. You're done. Yeah. 7 years, kiddo.
That's the downfall of the powerful, right? They begin to trust in other forces other than God. Paul? Well,
even in some of our scriptural interpretations, some of the authors of the Bible take on like words like servant instead of slave. And there's a distinct difference between a slave and a servant. Mm-hmm. We are slaves, not servants. Mm-hmm. And we sometimes like the idea of servant because it gives us a little bit of power alongside of God instead of under God.
Yeah.
But we are not. And the world wants us to be the main figure. God wants us to be the minor figure. And the contrast is tremendous, tremendous. You know, it's just unbelievable. But it's the same here. You know?
Yeah, words can take on two different meanings, and the one you're pointing to is an excellent one. There's only one Greek word for servant and slave. It's doulos. And to be politically correct, English translators want to put in servant because it makes it sound like I can call some of the shots. Whereas in that culture, it was known that it was a person who was a slave. And so the scriptures lose some of their punch if we start taking on the world's connotations to words. Because in the one you're thinking of course, is in Romans, where it says that we are now slaves to righteousness. And righteousness is the best master that we could have, right? So of course we want to be a slave to righteousness. Because we used to be a slave to sin, and we knew what a cruel, terrible master he was. And we rejoice that we are freed from him. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Okay, can we go on to the next paragraph? Let me read my little introduction to this paragraph first, because our discussion's going to go in a whole different direction from this point on. Many Bible interpreters have felt that at some point in chapter 11, the vision goes beyond just foretelling what Antiochus would do, and that the evil king in the vision becomes a symbol or prototype for great forces of evil in the end times. Read verses 40 through 45 and see if you find support for this interpretation or not. Let me read 40 to 45. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt with the Libyans and Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. Do you agree with the interpreters who say this is not Antiochus, but this is some foreshadowing of a greater king or leader in the end times? What do you think? Joyce?
Well, in my research on Antiochus, it says that in 168 B.C., he tried to invade Egypt for the second time. The first time, he had little success. Second time, Rome joined in with Egypt against him. So
So he got squelched. Mm-hmm. So because he was mad, he went back to Israel and destroyed everything he could, including the Holy Mountain, which makes me think that it really is discussing Antiochus.
Okay. Because Antiochus invaded Egypt twice, Joyce thinks that this is describing Antiochus, the historical events of Antiochus' life. Anyone else?
Well, what I find interesting is that when you read the Bible study, the guide that, you know, I've already got a Bible, like you said, that, you know, so I can follow along and see. It's like they give us all this history of Antiochus and all the others, and then as soon as they get to 40 and 45, they just completely switch over to Antichrist.
Off, yeah.
And I just, when I read it, I said, well, I think that's wrong.
Yeah. It's lack of continuity. What? Where is there a spot that would lead you to believe, okay, now, after all these paragraphs of history, why all of a sudden would you go to just a vague description? I agree with you.
Well, it's, you know, I think I agree too, but it's these words, at the time of the end.
Okay, that was our first clue in here. At the time of the end. Now, we have had that phrase before, describing the end of a certain period of history. But what intrigues me is, let's just look at the beginning of chapter 12 once. Let's not isolate that, because that's part of the vision too. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Well, verse 2, I don't think we can interpret it any other way other than the resurrection of the dead on the last day, right? And if the paragraph right before it says, at the time of the end, well, we're getting close to the end of the world's history, right? So I do think that that's a very significant phrase in the paragraph.
Well, and then the first line of the next chapter is, at that time, referring back to something.
Exactly.
Back to what?
Yeah, the very first verse of 12. At that time. Well, the previous paragraph had said, at the time of the end. Pam?
Isn't there other reference, I don't know where it would be in the Bible somewhere, to the king of the south and the king of the north?
I didn't look that one up. You may be right, but I can't prove it.
I was looking at that phrasing. Mm-hmm. It seems to be more than just king of the south and the.
Just the fact that the vision chooses to always call them king of the north and king of the south, rather than identifying them as the king of Syria and the king of Egypt, may also be an indication that it's broader than just those specific kings. Yeah.
And can't sometimes the visions mean, you know, like now for Antiochus and later?
Yes. That's a good point, too. Remember that biblical prophecy is often like a mountain range. You know how it is? I can still see the Rockies the first time we ever drove up to them when I was a kid, and I'd never been around mountains before. First of all, they were so far in the distance, and we were driving across the plains. It seemed to take hours to get close to them. And then when we got to them, finally, it looked like a whole wall of mountains. But when we actually got into the mountains, I began to discover that, well, this peak is right here, and that peak over there, that is at least an hour to go yet, and it's much larger than this peak that I'm at right now. When from a distance, they all look the same. Biblical prophecy works that way, that it often describes events for the whole end times, and as you try to decipher them, from Daniel's perspective, you can't really tell what is referring to when Jesus comes the first time and what is referring to when he's going to come in the end times, right? Yeah, I think that is at work here. And so in the end, I couldn't really find myself departing from the traditional interpretation. I think this is referring to more than just Antiochus. Because look at the peoples who are mentioned in that last paragraph of 11. Look at 41, for instance. He will also invade the beautiful land. Well, now, if you're naming all the other countries, why would you use a metaphorical term for what is the beautiful land? Israel. It's clearly referring to Israel, right? But he uses a beautiful term to describe it, not using its proper name. But then he goes on and names actual countries around Israel. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. Well, I don't know of anywhere in history where it says that those three countries didn't fall to Antiochus. And as a matter of fact, they're surprising in this list because they're the only ones that stand when they were just tiny little countries. They were out in the desert. And, you know, so I'm wondering if the historical part is kind of falling away, and if it's trying to indicate that the people around the people of God are immune from all of this terrible result of sin that's going on. Not immune, I wouldn't say, but they're not enslaved by it, or they're not captured by it. But then look, too, at the next countries that come up when it speaks of Egypt. And then in 43, he will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt with the Libyans and the Nubians in submission. Well, I don't think anywhere you'd find that Antiochus went anywhere near Libya or Nubia. Do you know where Libya and Nubia are? If Egypt is right here, Libya is the next country over in Africa, right? And Nubia is south of Egypt. This little Syrian king would really have had to undertake a huge campaign in order to get to those areas. Actually, you know, the only kingdom that I could think of when naming all of these countries to get conquered in the future would be what kingdom?
Alexander.
Yes, either Alexander or Rome, right? I wondered for a while if it could be Rome because we've already covered Alexander. He was earlier in the vision, right? So the only one that I could think of that really applied to this paragraph completely would be Rome. But again, I'm wondering if we can even make it that specific. Here's another thing. Would you turn with me to Matthew chapter 24? Keep your finger in Daniel and look at Matthew 24, 15. Here's an interpretation of Jesus that I think will help us in interpreting Daniel. Matthew 24, 15. This is that long chapter where Jesus gives the signs of the end of the age. Matthew 24, 15, Jesus says, "So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." And it could go up, you can kind of scan it there, the whole paragraph would apply. You don't have time to look at the whole thing. But what obviously did Jesus know about the abomination that causes desolation? I think that's what he's referring to, the Romans taking over the temple area. But what is strange about his interpretation of it compared to the one we've just given for the abomination that causes desolation?
Well, he talks of it as it's yet to happen.
Yes, Jesus is talking about it as if it has yet to be fulfilled. And what interpretation did we give to it? That it happened already before Jesus. We said that it happened in 165 BC when Antiochus set up that altar to Zeus in the Temple Mount area. To me, this is an indication that a prophecy like this one has more fulfillments, that there are like waves of fulfillment for it. Because as a matter of fact, if you study Jesus' prophecy about what's coming, what even happens in his prophecy? What is he foretelling?
Well, first he mentions Judea specifically, which implies the Roman attack in 70 AD. And then he goes beyond that talking about the great distress, it's going to happen again.
Yes.
Which points more towards the end time.
Jesus, too, has prophecies intermingled that are going to come after him, right? That whole paragraph has all intermixed prophecies about how Jerusalem would be destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, and what would happen when he returned and the whole earth would be destroyed and the day of judgment would be there. So that leads me to believe that we should interpret Daniel as these waves of interpretation. That the abomination is when Antiochus offered the pig in Jerusalem, and it is also when the Romans invaded Judea and destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, and it's also describing what's going to happen in the end times during this time of tribulation. Yes?
Two things. One, do you think that also refers to now when there's a mosque set up on the...
I don't know if I'd be that specific about it, because as I warned us when we got into the visions, it's always more sure when a prophecy got fulfilled in Jesus' day, and Jesus and the apostles could say, now this is the fulfillment of this prophecy. And it's a whole different matter when things prophesied that would happen after Jesus. I'm not an inspired person. And so I wouldn't say definitively that is the fulfillment of this prophecy. It could be. It's interesting that the Dome of the Rock is on the Temple Mount. But just as when we were talking about, is the Pope the Antichrist? I don't know if I want to be dogmatic about that. There are certain things that he does that fit in these prophecies. But we don't have Jesus around to say, yes, now the prophecy is fulfilled. We don't have an inspired apostle to say, yes, this is how the prophecy is fulfilled. I think the whole wording of Daniel is left general enough that it's supposed to be a warning for us to watch out for certain things. But it also does not give us a license to say, you are that end time here, and you are that one, and you are the abomination, and I think we go too far if we start doing that. Pam.
God reveals prophecy to the prophet. Again, his vision of time is so different from ours. Ours is very, it's not dry, and God's is kind of, see, the kind of all mixed, yeah, maybe together.
It's part of God's eternalness, right? That for him, he sees events going on all over the world and at all different times in history. So when he reveals that to a prophet, it often comes in a way that we have a hard time sorting out. It's like when you've got a book where the pages are stuck together and it's hard to get those pages separated. It's very hard for us to be able to see into these wonderful visions that God has given. And so we need to be careful not to be too dogmatic about certain things. There are certain things that we can stake our faith on, right? Jesus Christ died on the cross for the sins of the whole world. We're not going to debate that with anyone. The Bible has made that absolutely clear. God created the world in 6 days, the way it says in Genesis, right? There's no point of debate among us. We're all unified at St. Mark's on these doctrines, right? But we might have a different interpretation when it comes to the visions of Daniel. Gwen.
I guess I read the Bible more on an elementary level to keep it simple for myself, mm-hmm. You know, to make it easier for me to read. I just remember, as you were saying about the mountains and getting closer and our study of Isaiah, it seemed like every time Isaiah prophesied on that day, that day was the end. And that was clear in Isaiah. That was the last day. That's when God was going to come, you know, Jesus' second coming. And so when I read at that time, I think of at that particular time, because it didn't say, like I said, I think of it elementary, it didn't say on that day, at that day, because I'm thinking time means it could be more than
than what he meant.
Yeah. But even in Isaiah, I think if we would go back, and it's been a few years since we studied it now, I think we would see certain times where in that day was referring to different things other than just the last day. Because sometimes in that day was describing Jesus' first coming. So I think it applies even to Isaiah. Okay, we are down to our last 5 minutes. So I would like to take you, give you an overview of this short chapter 12. We already discussed parts of it, so let me just pull out a few phrases. Who is Michael again? The archangel, whose job is? Protecting the people of God, right? He is specifically put over Israel in Daniel's day and over the people of God. And he's going to protect the people. There will be a time of distress. I think that's referring to the end times, the tumult as that day gets closer. It's not a, I don't find anywhere in the Bible that says it's a 7-year period of tribulation. I think that's taking isolated passages and trying to put them together. However, it is very clear from Daniel and Revelation that the times will become more evil and stressful as the day approaches for Jesus to come. And it's that distress that's being described here. At that time, the people, everyone written, found written in the Book of Life, I believe that's God's list of people who he knows will be in heaven. And those people whose names are written in that book, they're going to be raised up on that day. Daniel 12:2 is the clearest prophecy of the resurrection in the whole Old Testament. Multitudes who are in the sleep, in the dust of the earth, they will be awakened. And very clearly, that they will be raised, some to eternal life, others to contempt. Shame and everlasting contempt. I believe that's a firm foretelling of how there's only going to be one second coming of Jesus. That he's going to raise up both the living and the dead. The premillennialists say that the believers will be raised ahead of time, before the millennium, and the unbelievers after. I don't believe that at all. John 5, 28 and 29, Jesus says the same thing. There's only going to be one resurrection. Okay, verse 3. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, close up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge. I believe that when these men were inspired, there was a certain cutoff point where the book was finished. And now, your part of the revelation, seal it up. That's what's being described there. 5. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two others, one on this bank of the river and one on the opposite bank. Remember, the angel had been at the Tigris River in this vision. And now two witnesses come. One of them said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, how long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled? The man clothed in linen, this is the angel who gave the vision to begin with, who was above the waters of the river, lifted his right hand and his left hand toward heaven, and I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying, it will be for a time, times, and half a time. When the power of the holy people has been finally broken, all these things will be completed. Here we return to our phrase, this very vague phrase in Daniel. And I think this is the clincher in the interpretation that I just gave. That these prophecies apply in waves to various things that happen. And so a vague time period is given so that it could apply. You know, some people will interpret this as a year, years, and half a year, which could come up as 1 year plus 2 years plus a half year, 3.5 years, which was about the time that the temple was under the control of the Greeks in Antiochus' day. So that this phrase could describe what happened when that abomination that causes destruction took place. However, it can also apply to these end times where there is this vague number of time, times, and half a time. You guys don't know when this is going to happen. Going back to our discussion of how, you know, the last day is hidden, where Jesus even said, no one knows that day. date. Not the Son, not the angels, but only the Father in heaven. I believe that's why that phrase is worded that way. When the people are finally broken, I interpreted that as referring to the tribulation that will go on in the end. That, you know, the people of God are going to suffer these terrible things. You could compare it to verse 1. That's the context of it. But notice, the end of verse 1 says, but the people will be delivered from this distress that they have. I heard, but I did not understand. So I asked, my Lord, what will the outcome of this all be? He replied, go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. In your homework, did you divide that up? How many months does that come up to? 43, right. Which is a little over 3.5 years. It's 1 month over. So here is this 3.5 year period, about the time that the Greeks were on the Temple Mount. This was the terrible time, the abomination that causes desolation. But no, what's intriguing about the next verse? Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,335 days. How many more days is that?
45.
45 more days. So those Jews who persevered during the time of the occupation, they finally got the joy about 45 days later. But what would it teach us if you're applying this to time, times, and a half a time? If you want to put it on that broader mountain range of the end times, what would it say to you?
I don't know, the thing that came to my mind was Jesus' ministry.
Okay, Jesus' ministry was a similar time.
And then it was done, and then you have to wait.
Yeah. Or I wonder, too, if it's saying to us there's going to be a time of persecution or of suffering, but blessed is the person who can go just a little bit farther than that, because in the end, there's always going to be a blessed outcome for the believer. Because notice the very last paragraph. As for you, Daniel, go your way till the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. Daniel, remember, was almost dead. He was a very old man by this time. This is a promise to him. You will rest in the sleep of death, but then you will be raised, right? My last question was, and this is the final point of Daniel, what is the end always like for a believer? Heaven is always waiting there, no matter what lies in between, right? So no matter what difficulties the Lord may allow us to go through, the end is always a happy ending for a Christian. And I think that's what he's coming. I think that's why the numbers are there. The suffering is going to seem to go on forever. It's going to seem to go on for 1,290 days. But just hold out for 1,335 days, and you will see the blessed end. I hope you enjoyed the study of Daniel. I know I sure did. If anybody else wants an exit survey, there it is. Also, if anybody would like to stick around, I need half of the chairs picked up. This half can stay where they are. This half can be picked up.
Good, I'm going to hand you these.